Welcome to the Leadership Labs with DeepRec.ai, a podcast where we delve into the fascinating world of deep tech entrepreneurship, company founders, and venture capitalists. I'm your host, Anthony Kelly, and I'm thrilled to have you join us on this exciting journey. In each episode, we explore the minds behind groundbreaking technologies, the visionaries who dare to push the boundaries of innovation, and the investors who fuel the growth of tomorrow's game changers. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Leadership Labs with DeepRec. Today's guest is Vadim Rogovsky, and he is the co-founder and CEO of 3D Look, recently a partner at Geek Ventures. And in this podcast, he's going to tell us about his journey on founding 3D Look to be a leading body modeling and personal size and fit business, as well as his most recent, I guess you could call it a career move, but he's now working as a partner with Geek Ventures. He's going to talk to us about what he considers good investment criteria. Geek Ventures have actually been investing quite a lot of money, even over the last 18 months, up to about 31 in the portfolio now, Vadim?
It's 34 already. Yeah, we are moving fast.
Yeah, that's fast moving given the market. So look, Vadim, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Anthony. Thanks for having me here. Excited to answer your questions and tell a bit of my story. Yeah.
Yeah, nice. I mean, look, before we then jump into 3D Look and Geek Ventures, tell us a little bit about you. Where's your background been that you've got such an entrepreneurial spirit?
I'm originally from Ukraine, from Odessa. I moved to New York like 18 months ago, beginning of last year. But I've been living between Ukraine and the US for quite a long time, maybe for the last 12 years since I started to actively build startups targeting like US market. And yeah, I have business management degree in Odessa National University, and had also like lots of other like management leadership programs, including the ones in Stanford. But I was not technical. I don't have technical degree, technical background, but I'm pretty technical for a non-technical person. I mean, because I had to develop my first website, right, a very long time ago. So I had to do everything. I was very hands-on in the beginning because at that time it was not easy to find any kind of courses and programs to learn how to do it, and also like to find freelancers to do it for you. So yeah, I mean, I was just very fascinated about startups, very curious about them, and I treated them since the beginning in the beginning it was purely hobby, because I combined this with university, and also I had kind of a part-time job in a software company, so it was purely like a game for me, like a hobby. And this attitude actually helped me to start seeing some successes and some early successes and be able to scale it quickly. I think the attitude is one of the key reasons why something started to work for me. Yeah.
Yeah, nice. I mean, look, always great to hear as well. You know, what was growing up like then, I guess, for you to move into entrepreneurship, right? You founded a couple of different companies, you know, the first one being 12, 13 years ago, right? So let's use the word serial founder because you've done it so many times. How, like, was business talked about for you around your life as a young person, or did you just really pick up your own interest in it as you grew older?
I started to basically to launch some very small projects when I was like in second grade in university, and as a hobby, as I said, yeah. But then I just started to try different things. I quickly switched to different things because probably I was still looking for my passion for the industry that I'm going to focus on for at least like 5-6 years. And so I had a small gaming studio. We create we create gaming apps for Facebook, or I have web studio. We did websites for some original big businesses in Ukraine. I had an e-commerce store that was selling t-shirts and different apparel with electronic equalizer screens that reacted to the sound. It was a big thing in like 20 like 2009, like lots of stuff. A social media marketing agency, and then eventually I got into advertising, like into ad tech, and that was my first passion. Where I spent how many? Like maybe like 7 years, and built two companies. Kind of sold one of them on a very early stage, so it didn't take off as fast as expected. But it was doing well in the regional market, but I still sold it to US-based company called Verta Media, and my company was called Ad Center. And yeah, and the second company, I managed to grow it to 13 million of annual revenue before I kind of did partial exit there through secondaries and went and invested money into 3DLOOK. So 3DLOOK is in my second industry for me, totally new industry for me, and where I found my new passion. So I realized that my kind of cycle, let's say my like best productivity cycle for me is like plus minus 7-8 years max. I think that I'm not a person who enjoys building one company for 20 years, at least as of now. I want to kind of understand that I have some cycles and then I want to do something else.
Yeah, quite a shift. You know, you've gone from marketing into 3DLOOK. Talk to me about founding 3DLOOK. Did you intend to found them as an AI virtual fit solution, or were you sort of just coming out at size recommendation initially?
Well, it's a very interesting question because we started from a technology. So we just, I mean, for me, again, I treated it mostly, I was still running my previous company and I was just fascinated, but I was very curious about computer vision and AR. It was 2016, with lots of stuff was going on in that area. In that area, lots of startups, some exits, big rounds. So I was looking at that, into that. I got really fascinated, really curious, and I just basically wanted to see if we can solve the problem of finally solve the problem of measuring human body using a smartphone camera that many people tried to solve for the last 30 years or 20 years before we started using Kinect cameras, web cameras, and didn't succeed. And I thought maybe it's the right time. So I started purely out of curiosity. And basically, we didn't start the way we started it was not the way how it's usually described in a startup books, that you need to do 100 interviews with clients, then you need to understand what do they need, etc. No, we did it in a different way. And in life, I see often when people just do it in a different way, and then they write books how to do it in the right way. But still, I mean, we started what if we solve this technological challenge, big challenge, then we can apply it into many, many industries. And then we'll find out, we'll do customer development, we'll focus on industries that need it most, that feel the pain, that we can cure. And then we will go and find product market fit there. So that's how it started, yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, look, you guys must be one of the first to do, virtual fit, virtual fashion, virtual fittings, virtual try-ons, right? It's even now, right? It's still not widespread.
Yeah,
so to go back and look at it, 2016, it reminds me a little bit of the Arthur Guinness when he made Guinness. He rented the site where they produce Guinness for 8,000 years. Everyone said he was crazy, right? But you went in and you started a product in a market that didn't exist at the same time. Most people would call it almost startup suicide, right? You don't have a right to succeed, but you did. So I really want to get into, where that came from before we talk about Geek. So yeah, talk to me. What in your opinion made 3DLOOK successful?
I think, first of all, it's right timing because we definitely, I thought that at that time that lots of shifts are happening in the industry, so server infrastructures and GPUs were getting actually more, I would say, like affordable and also more powerful. Secondly, some scientific papers were released that were talking about different things that we could use potentially. Like consumers were kind of ready to just basically like taking multiple photos every hour. So for them, it's not a big deal. And it was a big obstacle for people who tried to solve it like 10 years earlier than we did, right? Because consumers were not ready to take photos.
To
get any sort of personalization or whatever. So yeah, lots of, and also retailers, brands started to be obsessed about sustainability. No, not start, but the shift has started. I mean, but it took some time and COVID also accelerated it. But at least the shift has started. They started to talk about it, started to think about it, that sustainability is important. Fast fashion is not the great business model anymore. That environment is, basically apparel industry is one of the most polluting industries in the world, that is very bad for environment. So lots of things. And also Generation Z started to become a like dominant kind of like dominant shopping force, like buying force. And all of this combined kind of showed us that, yeah, maybe it's the right time. But so I think right timing is super critical. It's just number one. And number two, I think that we were really, we started in a, with a very methodical approach. We really hired a super strong team. And you, I mean, being in, at the time, being in, being between US and Ukraine, I kind of combined the strengths of both countries, because in Ukraine, we hired really strong and very kind of focused, like very, I would say, people with narrow specialization, narrow focus, experience in computer vision, deep learning, 3D. And in the US, I found my co-founder, Whitney, who spent 25 years in retail and manufacturing in apparel. It was a great a match. And my technical co-founder, Ivan, is in London, so he kind of spent lots of time in deep learning.
Yeah.
So three of us, I mean, I bring business background to the table, Whitney brings industry experience, Ivan brings deep tech experience. I mean, this is also one of the important things. That also like diverse founding team, right? And yeah, we were iterating super fast. And we were just talking to so many industries. We had a very methodical approach to customer development. We spoke to so many companies and so many industries, and I personally did hundreds of such calls before we actually found the couple of industries that we wanted to focus on. So let me summarize. Right timing, number one. And I think it's one of the most important things. Diverse founding team, it's number two. And number three, it's fast iteration. Yeah.
Good. Do you know what? I like that you touched on diverse founding team. I think it was Anthra recently done a report on unicorn businesses. I know, look, we don't want to necessarily just talk about unicorn businesses, but the percentage chance of successful startups is like dramatically higher. You're talking like 300-500% more if you have that diverse team. And I guess it's quite hard now, right? Because we're talking deep tech. People are meeting at university. People are meeting at events. They're meeting people that they know and like who are also going to be in deep tech. So they go in, they build this amazing product, and then there is a lack of business skills to make something of it, to bring it to the market. As I said, no deep tech person wants to do 100 pitches. No deep tech person wants to speak to 100 customers, right? It's just not what they enjoy. But ultimately, it makes a really big difference. Wanted to ask, yeah, what was it like going for investment? You know, being a size and fit company before size and fit was a thing.
So I've been financing the company in the first like 18 months, maybe almost 2 years. But then I realized like, yeah, we need more capital. We need to scale our development team, first of all, really double the size at least. So because I saw some opportunity window I didn't want to miss, and we had to accelerate development efforts. So I just started to raise from a network. I had a pretty good network at the time already, because it was not my first startup, not my first journey. So I just started to basically write on I was writing on Facebook about, so I mean publicity also helps, because if you have some audience and you share it, you start sharing, like people should not be afraid of that someone is going to steal their idea. It's such a stupid thing to be afraid of someone stealing an idea. I wrote so many posts about it, because it's just, I mean, I think people need to share their, like, as soon as they start something, even before they start, and they have at least some audience on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, they need to share it with folks, because they can find feedback. They can find early employees, co-founders, investors. That's what I did. And I was basically sharing our experience, like sharing our updates, what works, what doesn't work. And then when I decided to raise money, for me, it was much easier, because I already knew some people who were really deeply interested in this topic. They were asking, some of them were asking me, like, hey, maybe we can invest. So I was raising, not at that time when I started raising, we still were not like if it's a startup. You're still like AI company working on the core technology, pre-revenue, pre-product, but had API, had some demo application, but it was just really like deep tech company. It was not easy to raise for a deep tech company still. So, I mean, yeah, so my first kind of maybe like first million that I raised, it was purely for people who knew me, and they were all from tech, but they knew me and they invested kind of in just in this because I did it. But then, obviously, when we started to raise like a proper seed round with some institutionals, then already I had to show them much more information and some validation. And it was much harder because, yeah, at that time, to raise for a mobile body scanning company approaching fashion retail, it was not an easy task. So I had to speak for seed round, maybe... For seed round and A round combined, so let me tell you this. After we raised A round, I had more than 200 investors in my CRM system, right? So I had to talk to like 200 investors to raise both seed and A. And seed was much harder. A was fast. I mean, because A was already, I raised A from people who knew us since seed. We can talk about investor updates, how important it is, etc. But if you want to dig deeper into this, but seed was the hardest part.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people that, you know, you want to, if people don't invest in it, it's because they're most likely, they might like the product, right? But they want to see results. If you can keep the results coming through regular reports, monthly or quarterly, I've heard people having success where a VC they're rejected from says, hey, let me know when you're raising again. And then they're kind of, I guess if you think of it in the VC's vision, they're putting the A-list pretty much straight away. You know, the relationships are there. If you're a salesperson, that's a piping hot lead, right?
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, VCs want, basically, VCs want to get comfortable. They are people. They want to get comfortable. They want to know you. And in order to know you and that you do what you say, that you do what you commit to, that you are regularly deliver, even if you don't hit your... ambitious objectives, but at least you're consistently going where you want to go.
Yeah.
So the investor updates is the best tool to make VCs feel comfortable with the founder.
Nice. So I want to talk about outside where you've mentioned some of the key attributes that you put down to success. And you mentioned, you know, obviously knowing people, knowing your market, right time and good founding team. Let's talk about the strategies and approaches that you built into the company for success, right? Of course, managing in three different locations, never going to be easy. Hiring people, not going to be easy, particularly deep tech, right? I know firsthand. Like, what did you have to do then outside of the core topics of finding team members, getting product market fit, getting everyone together, getting talent in? Like what else was important to you in terms of creating a strategy to move forward? Was it partnerships with retail brands? Was it, I don't know, like you tell me.
It's a very good question. So do you want to, do you want me to focus on hiring my early team members? Like,
Yeah, if it's higher than early team members that you attribute to the success, let's go with that.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, of course. I mean, I think some of our team members, I mean, I think, yeah, a healthy part of our actual team members are with us for more than 5 years. I mean, they're part of the core team that we had since the beginning, because those people came to 3D Look. I mean, I think, and even now we see, based on our NPS surveys that we run every quarter, et cetera, to see how people kind of, what's the attitude to the corporate culture, et cetera, what people like, what people don't like, et cetera. We do it every quarter, and we see that mostly people here, not because of money, because we never paid more than a market price, never. Just, even when we headhunted people, often, we were looking for people who really were kind of excited about this. And one of the easy ways to see the person is excited about this is if a person just goes and basically uses our product. Or finds a client, finds a product, and then shares experience, even without us asking for it, right? This is one of the easy things to do. So we never paid more, if people just wanted kind of money, it's not, I mean, and it's main motivator, it's not a fit, right? So, and if people wanted comfortable, comfort zone, predictability, lots of, like, to understand what you're going to do in 6 months, in 12 months, probably also not here. And we're pretty open about it. I mean, so, and I've been writing about it on social media. I got lots of negative responses to that, but lots of positive responses too, right? And this is kind of, and that's why we have people kind of, their expectations and our expectations are pretty much aligned. And they love what they do. So that's why they can be much more productive than if it was just a hired gun, like, just basically the coverage just works from 10 to 7 and that's it.
Yeah, so do you know what? Perfect that you mentioned it, because those things aren't easy to find, first off, but that's a great way to evaluate someone's interest in your company. Have they checked you out, checked out your users? But you mentioned that most of the core team, they're there 5 years. Like, that is unbelievable. It's really hard to do. You can't do it. It comes down to creating cultures, but I want to ask, outside of cultures, did you sort of introduce any other retention tools that might keep people beyond the standard, let's say, 18 months in tech?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we when we incorporated, we immediately allocated a stock option pool for founder for employees, and we basically started to. So we tested different approaches. We did annual or semi-annual sometimes salary reviews, performance reviews, and we had an approach like to basically granting stock option to people who really showed some outstanding results. We also automatically granted stock options to people who were promoted or who were hired on at least like director level positions. We also sometimes tested an idea to offer either promotion in cash or promotion in stock option, like not promotion, like the raise in cash or raise in stock option. Some people chose stock, but some people chose money. Some people chose a bit of both. So we experimented a lot. And I can tell you that now maybe like, I don't know, 50% of our team, maybe 60%, they have stock options.
Okay, that's great. That's a really good way to look at retention, getting people in. Now let's talk again sort of about strategy, the approaches that you've used. So you mentioned for like 18, 24 months you were just building AI, didn't know who the customer was. What was the strategy or approach for that, right? And particularly, look, you were financing it. Must be pretty hard to set expectations from everyone, or was it?
Oh yeah. Because it's R&D, and early on I learned that it's very important. It's more art than science to keep an optimal level of pressure, but not too much, and without too much bureaucracy, processes, tracking, etc. For the R&D team, because when you hire like, I would say genius, super smart people, like super nerdy people, to work on some super, super to work on some stuff that is more research driven without any clear outcomes, right? You need, yes, they have to have some accountability, but when you basically pressure them too much, they just quit, or they just, at least they become like, I don't know, they become less motivated. So, and I did some basically trial and error. I pushed too much sometimes, then I backed off and I saw, and basically didn't have any accountability for some time. And then I saw that, okay, it's also bad. So I was kind of trying different approaches. And I think I found some kind of balance over the after all these years, when I kind of give them the space, but they have some kind of at least expectations when they need. So they have some kind of a deadline when they need to show at least something. But the deadline is not like a week or a month. Ideally, a quarter. We have quarterly planning. And within a quarter, they know we have OKRs. Every quarter, we basically, as a team, we come up with our objectives, key results, right? And R&D team definitely is, they're also a part of it, very involved. And then they basically, they have their OKRs that come from them. I challenge it sometimes, so we kind of meet somewhere in the middle. But and then they know that within this quarter, they at least need to show something. Or if it's not happening, at least they need to be proactive and talk to me in advance, so we will understand what do we do.
Nice. How did that flip then to when you started to have a customer market fit? Were you then going from short-term goals to long-term growth objectives straight away?
I mean, we did a lot of customer development, right? Lots of conversation. I mean, and our customer development was more like, how to say, we started it super early when we didn't have even nothing nearly like no problem. Basically, the anything we had was like an API, right? And we released this API on we did our first press mention with the API, I think back in 2017, we were not incorporated. And we already started to have inbound, lots of inbound. Like one VentureBeat article brought us several hundred inbound leads. And even also I met my co-founder, Whitney, because of that VentureBeat article, right? So we started, so I think customer development is the most effective tool when you get inbound, because they already want to talk to you. You don't need to, because we did both. We did outbound, inbound. Inbound worked much better. So basically, we had three industries to evaluate. We wanted to evaluate, first of all, like entertainment industry, like gaming apps, etc. We had this avatar idea, first of all. Secondly, it was like health and fitness apps, like to see your progress, track your progress. And now, actually, this idea is coming back. We're now started again the conversations to find some use cases in health and fitness. Yeah. And third was like fashion e-com. And in fashion e-com, we really found the pain immediately, while in the first two industries at that time was more like nice to have. But in fashion retail, we found the pain. And then that's what the industry we decided to focus on 100%.
Nice. Good. Let's talk about Geek. 18 months have been crazy, right? You mentioned 34 investments. Talk to us first about who they are, why you've sort of partnered up at Geek.
Yeah, so while I've been, in parallel with running my own startups, I realized that I wanted to do something else, at least 10 to 20% of my time, because it's a great mental exercise. Also, just helped me to get additional perspectives, right?
Yeah.
And to learn from people, to share my experience, to give and to take and to exchange and et cetera, and to help, first of all, the ecosystem, because I was also I'm still very passionate about kind of the Ukrainian startup ecosystem and just Ukrainian founders globally, right? And so I've been, my first kind of project outside of my startups was when we launched startup, the first startup accelerator in Ukraine called Wannabes back in 2012, invested in 12 startups with my two partners. We invested our own money in 12 startups just at the presentation stage, more or less, and did lots of mistakes, but a couple of companies are still alive and doing pretty well, but the majority just basically folded quickly. And then I started some occasional angel investments. Then when I started 3D Look, I just dived into 3D Look for like 4 years, just completely, or like 5 years. But then I just realized that still something is missing. And I started again, like to talk to people who wanted to launch their VC funds, because I wanted to get my kind of angel investing mentoring expertise to the next level. And that's how I had a good friend like Iher. He's in New York as well. He lived there for more than 10 years. He has been investing in more than 100 startups during that time as an angel. And he had a great experience, but we had very complementary backgrounds, because he was never a founder, but he was a tech executive at Google, Facebook, WeWork, a couple startups. And I was always a founder. And when he said that he's going to launch a fund, I said, well, just let's do it together. Let me help you. And then that's how it happened. It was like a startup, because I spoke to several other groups of people who invited me to join them. But there were lots of bureaucracy, lots of some things that I didn't understand. But here we still treat Geek Ventures as an early stage startup. We have two analysts also, so we are a team of four, hiring a few more people now. But yeah, it's like an early stage startup, and I'm mostly responsible for our portfolio. So I as a more experienced entrepreneur, I help our founders to overcome some obstacles. Sometimes I motivate them, sometimes I challenge them. But the main goal is to help them raise money on higher valuation next round. And also, yeah, obviously to grow sales marketing wise, and especially if it's B2B, and we mostly have B2B startups in the portfolio, I can help a lot.
Nice. Yeah, pretty cool. How are you managing to pull off almost 2 investments a month?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we on average have like, yeah, it's almost 2 investments a month now. I think we have a strong and really, really growing every month the inbound flow of startups. We have several hundred startups coming to us every month without any advertising. It's mostly like me and Ihar writing on social media, and it's like through personal brands. And basically, we also sometimes host events in New York, in Lisbon during Web Summit, right? But that's it. But people find us through word of mouth, references, etc. And yeah, that's why our two analysts help us to narrow down this funnel. They basically act as initial filters. Then they write memos on the most interesting companies. And then we just every week we sit down, discuss it all together, and make decisions. So that's why we try to we can operate really fast.
Okay, great. Look, let's start wide. What do the analysts look for? What do they consider something worthy for you and Igor to see?
Yeah, I mean, what is important for us? I mean, of course, we have some mandatory criteria, and these criteria act as a media filter. It's like in Delaware incorporation. So if it's a startup from Europe incorporated in European country, we cannot consider it, right? Then it's immigrant, at least one of the founders should be immigrant, like immigrant in the US, because we are focused on the US market. So, I mean, the person who was not born in the US, right? Because this is our kind of a mission to help immigrant founders. We deeply care about it. And then there has to be some meaningful technology. So technology has to be not just some add-on, but a core component of the company's value prop and core asset of the company, right? So we don't invest in some just subscription applications or some content media projects without technology. We don't invest in these things. So, this is kind of, these things act as just initial criteria. Yeah, but then we look at, and our analysts look at, like, they prioritize second-time founders, like repeat founders, very important. They prioritize, so we don't invest pre-product. We often invest pre-revenue, but not pre-product. There has to be some MVP. We need to test it. We always try to test it, play with it. So yeah, we also look at definitely like cap tables to make sure there's nothing weird there, right? We look at founding teams, like share, how they distribute shares, what are the roles? Like we look at founder dynamics a lot, like when. Even when you get on a call with founders, you already see like if something is wrong. Sometimes we see that the CTO, for example, is much more active on the call and answering all the questions, calling the shots, than the CEO. I understand there's some problem there, so it might explode in the future. That's just one of the things, right? Very obvious. But yeah, we'll look at such things. How founders interact with each other. Who else? They have on a team already, although we understand team is probably under 10 people, usually under 15. Then they look at the market, etc. But this is the things we because a lot of our bets are on founders still. The founders have to operate on a big and growing market, and it's better that it's growing is more important than big. But this is it, yeah.
Nice. So, look, if you were to sort of take everything then that you know as being successful over your own entrepreneur career, your last 18 months at Geek, like, and then even you mentioned, you know, helping founders get better valuations on the next funding rounds. Look, what advice and what guidance are you giving these founders when they're seeking investment or looking for established strategic partnerships?
Well, first of all, I really encourage founders to be good at negotiations, because negotiations about specific terms with investors, because lots of founders, especially from Eastern Europe, but not only, but especially in Eastern Europe, they don't understand what negotiation is. They think in negotiation is a zero-sum game. They just one party wins, another party sucks, and that's it. So I just encourage them really to prioritize negotiation and also to prioritize speed over greed, right? Because many of them I want to raise on this valuation cap and that's it, and I'm going to spend even if it takes a year, I would not back off. I'm saying, hey, it's just stupid, because speed means everything. In a startup world, speed means everything. So you'd rather just, because I'm helping them to understand that if they win big, and this is the goal, to win big, then this marginal kind of changes in the valuation wouldn't matter at that point of time. And this is kind of very common thing that help them with. And also, of course, yeah, sorry.
I was going to say, there's always the fear that an enterprise company that you think is not in the AI game pulls out a product that can absolutely kill 10 startups in that space as well, right? If you don't go fast.
Yeah. So speed is critical. Yeah. And also one of the common issues that I see is that they, as soon as they raise, after they read all these articles about the recession, end of the world, end of the venture capital, and listen to some VCs, like textbook VCs, I call them. They're like, oh, I need to sit on my capital, just don't spend it because I need to have 10 years of runway, like whatever. But I said, hey, you're not a bank. You didn't raise the capital to pay out like the yield investors. You need to spend it. You need to grow. And you need to hire people. You need to spend. And it seems to be an unconventional advice, because usually they told me, oh, VCs never told us something like this. But they said, hey, this is my entrepreneurial part. Kicks in here, because they're saying, hey, you need to hire these people, because again, speed. And as a founder, you cannot do everything. Lots of founders just do everything, and they do everything on a mediocre level. I say you need to hire people to delegate. So I also help them to scale, basically.
Yeah, it's actually quite like that at the moment, isn't it? Like a lot of companies and a lot of VCs are cash reserve high and spending quite low.
Yes, and if it's just textbook VC who never was an entrepreneur, he just doesn't understand it. I mean, and that's why I'm trying to give a real advice based on my real experience.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's where it is, right? I think we're 60% down year on year, H1 2023 to H2 in terms of investment value from European VCs. I know that's not necessarily where where you're focused on yourself, but I would gauge it's quite similar in the US.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I saw some kind of articles, some signs that probably the industry started to recover a bit. I saw some latest report on Carta.com. But it's just, I think it's just basically, it's a number game, I think it's because of some big deals in generative AI space. I think we need to see the subsequent quarters to understand if it really is something consistent rather than some single spike.
There's anomaly companies out there, right? You got Mystic from France, who got a couple of hundred million. Got 120-ish, something like that. So they've obviously massively pulled it up, but they are the anomaly, making that figure probably look even better than what it should be. Otherwise, probably down, 65, 70?
Yeah.
Where else are founders not doing as well as they could? We're talking speed being one. What else should they be looking at?
Yeah, so speed, number one. Two, don't be afraid to hire, but of course, but don't be afraid to delegate, because it's advice for the CEOs, because CEOs need to be focused on raising money, hiring people, and bringing them first clients. But CEOs should not be doing data science, reports, CRM, coding, God forbid, or it just doesn't make sense, right? So it's number two, delegating and hiring. Three, I think should be always kind of in the fundraising mode, more or less passive active. I mean, of course, not all the time active, but by passive, I mean spend at least 10-20% time just being open to talking to inbound. To investors coming through inbound channels, right? Going to events, spending some time to grow the network, because this network will be super critical when you switch to active mode. Four, it's also developing personal brand, personal network all the time, because this is one of the biggest assets of the founder. And you can leverage this asset so much. And not a lot of people understand it, so I also try to explain it. That, yeah, it's just this is from the top of my head.
Nice. Some really good advice there from experienced founder and now in the VC game. Are you ready to jump into the final three quickfire questions, Vadim?
Okay.
Good. I'll start off with the easiest one. Piece of content, book or a podcast. So what would you recommend for other listeners?
Well, I think as for the, I'm not a very podcast person. However, I have some favorite ones. So I think A Masters of Scale by Reid Hoffman. I mean, I don't listen to it regularly, but when I do, when I'm, for example, in a taxi going from the airport back home, I listen to it, and I never was disappointed. So A Masters of Scale, I highly recommend.
What would you say your three non-negotiables are when it comes to yourself for leadership?
Can you please elaborate on non-negotiables?
Non-negotiables, like you wake up every day, you have three sort of traits that you don't let slip. They're like a part of you.
In a personal life, more or less. Okay.
Things that you find make you successful, yeah.
It's like definitely a routine. I mean, everyone should have a routine. And I'm trying to be very persistent in terms of my routine. Doing sports, morning exercise, definitely like scheduling my day, my weeks and days in advance. So I definitely book some time, book some slots for some personal things, but so I kind of try to structure my agenda in advance. So first of all, it's like a routine. Secondly, it's personal goal setting and personal accountability. So I do I set up annual goals for myself, monthly goals, and then I every week I just sit down for 10 minutes and try to see and reflect on my goals for the current months and see what's the progress. So I think personal, to being treating yourself as a company, doing strategic sessions for yourself, and some, like, even using maybe OKRs, I mean, if you prefer. Yeah, but yeah, personal accountability. And number three, I think it's, also, of course, a founder has to, should be able, should know how to have rest, how to unwind, definitely super important. And it's not about how much you work. It's about just how, how you can make sure that you maintain the biggest productivity in yourself and while being in harmony with yourself and not being just miserable at the time.
You know, I have to say those are truly fantastic sort of non-negotiables. I would probably put them down to quite similar to my own, which is quite funny. I'm quite interested to see where this one goes now. If you had the chance to go back and do it a little bit differently, what would you change?
You mean in 3D Look?
In anything. In the last 20 years.
Yeah, I will tell you what. Just one thing. I've been thinking about it when I moved to New York, like completely, like with my family, that I would do it much earlier. Yeah, because I always was thinking that, hey, I don't need to move. Completely. I can go fly back and forth, back and forth. I still have my home base in Ukraine, but lots of friends, employees, partners in US. Basically, I'll live between two countries. No, as soon as I moved, and I'm just after some time, like after 6-9 months, I understood there is a big difference, because then I started to take advantage from the community outside around me. That was just, I couldn't take these advantages when I was just commuting back and forth. So definitely I would move to the US probably like 10 years earlier. Yeah.
Do you know what's quite funny? What you've just mentioned would perfectly fit in with helping your non-negotiables. It would give you a better routine, it would give you better work-life balance, and you'd be able to assess your goals a lot mm-hmm. easier, because you'd know where you are at the end of every day.
Yeah, totally.
Nice. But look, Vadim, that takes us up for a time. Thank you for being a guest on the Leadership Labs.
That concludes another enlightening episode of the Leadership Labs podcast. If you found today's episode thought-provoking and informative, be sure to subscribe to the Leadership Labs on your preferred podcast platform or on YouTube. Thank you once again for joining us on this journey through the Leadership Labs. Until next time.